This hour, as you contemplate what you are going to have for breakfast this morning, we will discuss why our food choices are what they are. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, November 13th. Our guest is the author of The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. And we will talk about the evolution of our American diet, the industrial diet, its causes, consequences, and possible cures. Do you eat industrial food, processed foods? Are you concerned about our food system? What steers your decisions about what you eat? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Anthony Winson. He's a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Guelph in Ontario. He is the author of The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the industrial diet? Is that just another term for the American diet, the Western diet?
Well, I suppose you could say so, and in fact, in my book, I toyed with the idea of calling it the American diet because of the, the sort of pioneering role of American food companies in developing and promulgating that diet, you know, and spreading it around the globe now. What is the industrial diet? Well, it's essentially a whole suite of highly processed foods produced in through industrial methods, and the end result is, many products that are essentially nutrient poor, and the consequences of that, we're seeing all around us today, and we have for quite a number of years.
Yeah, so when did the industrial diet begin?
That's a very good question. In my studies of the development of this phenomena, I date it back primarily to the advent of roller milling. Actually, in your part of the world, the Minneapolis millers were among the first to adopt this. They basically borrowed a technology from the Hungarians, and this technology entailed the use of rollers instead of stone grinding wheels to process the grain, primarily wheat, and it was adopted because it was going to save them on labor costs, and it was going to be able to extract out from the wheat berry a couple of things, in particular the bran, which gave the resulting flour under the stone grinding method a kind of a browny gray color, and also the germ, which had certain oils in it, which tended to make the resulting flour under the stone grinding method go rancid fairly quickly. So up until the advent of roller milling, millers only had a very local market. They couldn't grind wheat into flour and have that flour be very shelf-stable for a long period of time. After roller milling was employed, they were able to do so, and that had a whole range of consequences. One, it allowed them to produce a shelf-stable product that could be marketed much more broadly. The other implication was that it extracted out most of the nutrients from that from the grain, and what resulted was what we could call nutrient poor. And that wasn't widely known at the time, but it was increasingly known by the early decades of the 20th century.
Yeah. So, what else besides roller milling it contributed to the industrial diet?
Well, wheat flour became a pretty important part of the diet of people through the 20th century. So, it was quite important. But looking at the subject, I found that there were three basic processes that seemed to me that to describe what was going on to produce what I call the industrial diet. And one was basically the simplification of whole foods. Another was the speed up in the producing of food products. And finally was essentially a process of adulteration, although it's sort of a new form of adulteration. Here we're talking about the increasing use of sugar, fats, and salts in the production of edible products.
Mm-hmm.
And those three processes, I think, are pretty central to producing this industrial diet.
Well, what historical factors contributed to us adopting this?
Yes, that's a crucial part of the whole story. And I when you look back, beginning with the roller milling process and the production of that new type of what they call patent flour, you had the advent, the early beginnings of what we call today mass marketing. And that was taken up further refined in a lot of ways by the new ready-to-eat breakfast cereal manufacturers, in particular Will Kellogg and the Post people and so on, in the early part of the 20th century, using a variety of the new techniques. This was even before radio was well established. And on the other hand, in the beverage sort of end of things, Asa Candler with Coca-Cola was also a major pioneer in the the establishment of these of modern mass marketing, and that that was able to do fairly early on in the 20th century was increasingly to normalize the consumption of highly processed edible products, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to think of what happened to jump from not grinding our wheat with stones, and then all of a sudden we have Hamburger Helper on the shelves.
Well, in there you have many decades of refinement of the processing and so on, but also many changes in society, of course. During the war, the troops were introduced to a number of highly processed products that helped. After the war, a lot of changes began to take place. You got the growth of suburbia. You got the development of car culture, and that changed how society was organized. So, that was very important. And by the 1960s or so, a momentous change with women increasingly moving out of the home, middle-class women in particular, working-class women had often been working out of the home for a very, very long time. But a mass move of middle-class women out of the home beginning in the 60s. And so the whole, concept of convenience food products became much more tenable and, much more appeal once that began to happen. And, people had more disposable income. Most people, had moved off the farm. The farm numbers began to decline after the 40s and become an increasingly urbanized culture. So people no longer have the means for producing really any of their own food. So they have to go to the marketplace to buy things, and that opens them up to the sales effort which is becoming increasingly massive, pushing highly processed product of all kinds in the post-war period.
We are talking about the industrial diet, talking about its evolution right now, the causes of the industrial diet. We'll talk more when we come back from this break about the consequences. And we'll also talk, as we move along, about some possible solutions. And we're welcoming your questions. Are you concerned about our industrialized food system? Do you try to avoid industrial foods? What steers your decisions about what you eat? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 20 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, November 13th. We are talking with Anthony Winson. He is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Guelph in Ontario. And he is the author of the book, The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. And we're welcoming your questions about the industrial diet and the rise of processed foods and the related health problems that are often blamed on the rise of processed foods. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And Professor Winson, let me ask you, what's wrong with having processed breakfast cereals in my pantry? That's a convenient breakfast to have, it seems, in the morning. Is it really unhealthy for me to have a bowl of Cheerios, for example?
Well, you know, what we're talking about here is a highly refined flour-based product, and in recent years, you know, with the population-wide weight gain, the issues around obesity and so on, some of the health consequences of that can include much higher prevalence of diabetes in the population and so on. So you're talking about products that tend to be what we call high glycemic products, and the glycemic index is an index that you know, looks at the degree to which something we eat spikes our blood sugar relative to a benchmark, which is glucose sugar. And this is a kind of product, ready-to-eat breakfast cereal, tends to be fairly high on the index because of the fiber has typically been refined out of it. That's a good part of it. Another part of it is that science has found that when these products are produced through an extrusion process, their starch molecules are modified in a certain way that they become even more even higher glycemic than they would be otherwise, and that is they tend to spike blood sugar even more rapidly. So if those are the type of products you are eating on a regular basis, and you know, increasingly larger proportion of your meals, then you know you're more likely to have some health consequences from that. So, it's just one small part in the whole industrial diet, but it's a significant one.
Yeah, I had actually this morning a bowl of shredded wheat, which is a whole grain shredded wheat, they say, and no added sugar. So if I make a choice like that, am I at least finding a healthy alternative?
Well, a better choice, you might go for something like large flake oats or a healthy granola product or something like that. But certainly that's the healthier end of the spectrum. But we have to keep in mind that if you look at advertisements to kids and so on, they're not pushing that type of product. I mean, we're basically weaning our children on highly refined, highly sugar-saturated products. The ready-to-eat cereal, breakfast cereal, the pre-sweetened ready-to-eat breakfast cereal in the supermarket is a product that gets retailers some of the highest returns and manufacturers as well. So they're very lucrative to produce, and not surprisingly, they're heavily advertised and they're pushed to primarily children, and you know, that's a big part of our reality too, and something we really need to think about.
Yeah, and when I was a kid, I was eating just a bowl of sugar is what it was, pretty much. Yeah, and
well.
And it's pretty well documented that that the rise in the industrial diet is linked to the rise in obesity in this country.
Well, you know, this whole issue of obesity, of course, is one of the big issues of our time. And what got me interested in this whole question, I think, and the exploration of the industrial diet was the fact that the medical science, you know, we're getting increasingly good at, tracking this and at looking at some of the major health impacts of it. But they were not particularly good at understanding, well, why is this going on? It's becoming, I think, increasingly clear that diet is a big part of this, not the only part. Lifestyle, activity levels, and so on are the other key part. But diet is very important. And, exploring diet, I think... I've had a long-term interest in food, and exploring diet has led me to be, you know, increasingly sensitized to the multiple ways in which our contemporary diet, the industrial diet that saturates our existence, is implicated in this major health issue. Yeah.
Well, I have many more questions, but so do our listeners. Jim in Cedarburg is with us first. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A moment ago, the guest talked about the modification of starch and the extrusion process of wheat products. I'm wondering if anyone's done a study on the effects of that of fats in the homogenization of milk, because as I understand, homogenization is basically extruding it through filters. Is that right?
Well, I'm not a dairy scientist, but I'll go with that.
So, Jim, you want to know about fat in milk?
In terms of, when I was a kid, you could still buy milk that was not homogenized.
Oh, you're talking about about pasteurized or?
Nope, that's different.
Okay.
Pasteurization is a heat process. Homogenization involves, I believe, an extrusion process that it puts the milk through filters. And that makes the fat globules very, very fine. And I'm wondering if that's done anything to its actual configuration at a molecular level.
Okay, I guess our guest doesn't know specifically about that specific process. But can you is there anything in the industrial diet about milk or dairy, Professor Winson?
Well, as to what's happening to the fat globules, I haven't read anything particular around that, to be honest with you.
Right, not that process that our caller was specifically talking about, but whether or not mass production of milk or, you know, if that has degraded the quality of our milk.
I think one of the things that I would point to and that I look at in the book is, you know, in recent years, people have become more conscious, I think, about eating red meat because they've been told that saturated fats are a problem and associated with, cardiovascular disease and so on. So they've been more and more conscious of that, by and large. So there has been a trend for, you know, beef consumption to decline. But what we found, it's not clear that saturated fat consumption is really declining that much, because what you've had is a massive increase in the consumption of cheese, which also is saturated animal fat. So I think that's an interesting thing we can bring dairy in. Manufacturers have found a whole variety of ways to push cheese in their products and to ramp up our cheese consumption, which has increased something like three times since the 1970s. So that's sort of counterbalanced a healthy trend to reduce saturated fat from red meat has been counterbalanced by increasingly eating high-fat dairy products.
Jeb on Facebook thinks that another another cause of our industrial diet or the degradation of our diet is GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Do GMOs fit into your research on the industrial diet?
GMOs are a very big topic in themselves, and I essentially steer clear of them. I mean, the reality is, though, because you have genetically modified corn and rice and soy and so on, and those are the building blocks of processed industrial foods, yes, they saturate what we call the industrial diet. And the only way to avoid those, if you think that's an issue, is to eat organic foods, because organic foods are, according to the certification process, cannot be genetically modified. So I think the science is really out on that. It's hotly debated, but there's increasing concerns about genetically modified foods. Have been, you know, concerns in Europe and Britain for a very long time, but less so here. But I think it's kind of a moving target at this point.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking with Professor Anthony Winson about his book, The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. And we'll continue to welcome your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says the rise of processed foods and related health problems can be blamed on three big changes in our food system: a pressure to produce food faster, the simplification of food, and the rise of sugar and fat as additives. We are discussing the industrial diet, its evolution, its causes, consequences, and cures. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Wednesday, November 13th. We welcome your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So do you try to avoid all industrial foods or processed foods? Why do you choose the foods you choose? Let us know. Our guest is Anthony Winson. He is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Guelph in Ontario. He is the author of The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. We talked about some on the pressure to produce food faster in the introduction of the miller, or what was it, the roller in the milling process. But why did we feel this pressure to produce food faster, Professor Winson?
Well, I think basically the pressure there is driven by a market economy, and those who can produce edible products faster will yield higher returns on their investment, because the whole system is based on the return of investment to capital that is invested in the production of food. Example that I use, what I call the speed up production of edible products, and ultimately a process that underlies the degradation of whole food. I use the feedlot system for producing meat as an example. Confined animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, are the predominant way that we produce meat these days, and that has been adopted because it is considered to be efficient. We can get a pound of meat cheaper that way. Of course, it doesn't account for the environmental costs and so on. That's not built into the price. But what do we lose from a nutritional point of view when we do that? When we're feeding cattle grain, largely corn-based feeds and so on. That's a very interesting thing, and there has been some science around that, and it focuses particularly on the fat profile. And what really got me interested in this was, taking my students to slaughterhouses and so on, as I occasionally do, and seeing the carcasses of beef cattle after slaughter, the incredible amount of fat that covers them, and it got me sort of interested in looking into this. I found out that cattle raised in the CAFO system, the feedlot system, have something like 7 times the amount of total fats compared to wild animals or beef cattle raised on grass. That's just one staggering sort of statistic. So there's a lot more saturated fat in the meat or in the carcass and the end meat products. But there's also an unhealthy balance between the omega-6 and the omega-3 fatty acids, the omega-3s being the good fats that we should have more in our diet. And that's disrupted in an unhealthy direction under this feedlot system. So that's by producing meat faster under this system, we degrade it in that way. We realize now increasingly how it's degraded by comparing it to grass-fed animals, animals eating what they're supposed to eat, and also wild meat. Some big contrast there.
Yeah, and you say that the industrial diet has simplified the availability of whole foods for us. How so?
That's another aspect, I think, of the degradation of whole foods, and it's kind of complicated, but in the modern food system, look at different commodities. If we take potatoes, there are thousands of potato varieties. And in the Andean countries in Peru, where potatoes are originally from, in a single valley, there can be 100 different varieties. Now, if we look at the two principal sort of vectors or sources of potatoes that we get, one would be fast foods and French fries, and the other would be the supermarket, we see there's been a huge varietal simplification or reduction in the varietal diversity that we end up with in our diet. So if you go to the supermarket, you're lucky to find maybe just 3 or 4 varieties of potatoes, and typically there'll be a white, there'll be a red, and there'll be, maybe a yellow potato, and that's it. For the French fry production, the industry uses, as far as I could tell, about 2 different varieties. So a drastic reduction in the varietal diversity. If you look at apples, a very popular fruit, there are thousands of apple varieties known to exist. When you go to the modern supermarket, how many varieties you have? And the surveys I've done around my region, you're lucky to have 6 to 8 totally. So why does that matter? Well, what we're finding out, and this is some research was done very close to where I live, is that the key seems to be phytochemicals, these micronutrients, and they vary quite a bit by different varieties. And why are those important? Well, the science of that is still in its infancy, but in the lab, it's been shown that cancer cells have been that their growth and development has been arrested by phytochemicals derived from plant sources. So it could, there does seem to be some interesting evidence that there's some potent anti-cancer properties available in fruits and vegetables. And if we are reducing the varieties of them out there so drastically, what I'm wondering is what type of nutrient benefits are we missing out on by doing that, you see? And so that's part of the degradation of whole foods.
We have another caller who's been waiting. Let me go to James in Rice Lake. Hello, James.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
My question was, and a lot of people, I think, in the back of their minds are aware that there's, something amiss with our industrialized diets. My question is there any alternatives as far as to stave that off, because a lot of people will go and, you know, buy these industrialized diets because they last longer on the shelf, they can store them longer, and it's more convenient. But is there, especially during the off-growing seasons, is there any alternatives that we can do besides, you know, going to the supermarket or the farmer's market and getting, you know, locally grown produce and stuff like that and canning it maybe through the winter? Is there any other alternatives that we could do to kind of stave off having to go and purchase that industrialized food?
I would say, yes, there certainly is things we can do. They're not necessarily going to be the most convenient things, but maybe preserving our health isn't going to be that terribly convenient, but it's maybe necessary that we do certain things. And I think the more we can include in our diet whole foods that are minimally processed, the better off we are. And you know, basically, I think it means that we have to rediscover the culinary skills that many of us have lost. And we have to put a priority on that, both for ourselves and for our children. And, yeah, that's maybe not the most convenient thing to do, but typically in the food system, if it's convenient, it's probably not that good for you. There may be exceptions, but as a general rule, I think that probably stands. So, you know, buying whole foods, unprocessed foods, and preparing them as much as you can yourself. When you buy foods in the supermarket that have been processed, minimally processed, read the labels carefully, you know, keep an eye on what kind of additives are there. The fewer additives, the better, typically. So I think, you know, until the food industry is able to produce much less minimally processed product that captures the nutrients that were once in there, and I don't know if they ever will be able to do that successfully. I think a certain amount of the responsibility comes back to ourselves and to get those culinary skills to prepare as much as we can at home, and maybe think twice before going out to, you know, out to eat, and being careful where we go out to eat.
We are talking with the author of The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. How do you go about healthy eating? Do you avoid industrialized foods? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 11 minutes before 7 on this Wednesday, November 13th. We are talking with Anthony Winson. He is professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Guelph in Ontario and the author of the book, The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. And we're talking about why we have this industrial diet, its consequences, and some solutions, some ways perhaps that how society can change. And we're welcoming your questions for him or welcoming your examples. Are you trying to change your diet? Do you steer away from the industrial diet? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So I wanted to ask you, when you said that one of the solutions is to buy whole foods when we can, or very minimally processed foods, what is it that, at least it seems this way, when I go to Whole Foods, it's more expensive to buy whole organic foods than it is the industrialized diet? Why is it cheaper to buy the industrialized diet?
Well, I think it's cheaper because, you know, they're typically produced with subsidized foods like corn and so on, and sugar. The basic ingredients of them are quite cheap to produce, and you know, I think that's the problem. But I don't know. I know, you know, being able to afford healthy food is often seen as something that is maybe difficult. But I wonder, you know, is it more maybe a matter of what we prioritize? We often find money for expensive cell phone plans and so on, and then we're reluctant to pay a little bit more for healthy food. And perhaps part of it is just getting our priorities straight, what's really important for ourselves, our health, our children's health, and so on.
Mm. Right, and certainly a lot of listeners can do that. Certainly I can do that. But there are areas where there aren't farmers markets. There aren't even grocery stores within walking distance. There are people whose incomes perhaps are low, that it's so low that it is much easier to pick up a box of macaroni and cheese than it is to, you know, go buy a bunch of fresh fruits and vegetables. Isn't there a bigger answer than just, you know, buy Whole Foods?
Yeah, of course there is. And I think a lot of those, you know, issues are emblematic of the growing inequalities in our society, you know, the people who really can't afford healthy foods. That's a result of the growth of poverty. We've seen the expansion of food banks year after year and so on. So those are wider problems of social inequality in society. And ultimately, you know, they can only be resolved with policies that will help reduce those inequalities. That would be my answer to that.
Let's take some more calls. Robin in Platteville is with us. Hello, Robin.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this program. Food inequality is so important. I'm an owner of a small organic grocery store in Platteville. We're a small rural community. And when I moved out here about 15 years ago, I hated that I had to go to Madison once a month to go to Willie Street Co-op and get my bulk grains and herbs. And I was an organic vegetable grower looking for a market for my products, and now I sell other people's products, but we have a corner grocery that sells organic food all year round with bulk products, and we do our best to keep the prices affordable, although not only do consumers have trouble paying the price, a small grocery has to pay the premium because we can't buy in the big sizes that Whole Foods or Willie Street buys. So we're paying a premium for our one box of apples every week, but we keep our margins lower, so hopefully we can feed our community. We also have an awesome farmers market that on their own raises money to supplement our food pantry. And so people on the WIC program and through our senior center and who need the food pantry can get a certificate, vouchers for our farmers market through the summer. And I believe we have a small winter market that they can use their vouchers for root crops. So our community is trying, but it's so important. But my first message was to the caller who said, how do you get away from the industrialized food system? It's looking for the organic grocer and buying in bulk and truly cooking for yourself, which does take time, but once you start doing it, you find ways to make it easy and tasty.
Thank you, Robin, very much for telling us what you're doing in Platteville. Maybe a quick react to that, Professor Winson?
I think what the lady is speaking about is a growing resistance I talk about in my book, or I write about in my book, to the industrial diet, and all kinds of alternative agriculture and food initiatives that have sprung up in the last less than 20 years, perhaps, all over North America, and I think it's very exciting to see that happening. I've been particularly interested in the farm-to-school movement. And I highlight a couple of organizations I consider really catalytic in producing change. One, Marin Organic in Northern California, and another called Food Share in Toronto. And they have really helped to get whole healthy foods into the schools and, you know, to get our kids and teens on the right track to build healthy habits around eating. There's so many, you know, negative, so many unhealthy messages out there through mass advertising around eating, and it's important that the schools become, you know, an area where healthy eating takes place and those habits develop. So there's some really exciting thing happening outside the schools as well. It's a time of change and hopefully transformation in food environments everywhere.
Sylvia in Clear Lake is with us now. Hi, Sylvia.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much. I guess just to mention, I'm a baby boomer, and it sounds like the author of the book might be too, so maybe we've experienced a real big change in things. But I grew up with my children working a full day, tired at the end of the day. Right now I have a one-and-a-half-hour commute into work, so when I get home, I'm tired. And sometimes people may think that cooking healthy is just out of reach because they're just exhausted. So I use a few strategies. One is the slow cooker on the countertop that allows me to kind of start something in the morning, and when I get home, dinner's on the table. Another is using very slow, low braising of meats in the oven where you can put it in, do 6 hours worth of work and come back and it's done. And a third is I just purchased and I'm starting to use a pressure cooker, which is an old-fashioned kind of implement, you know, another piece of what I'd call old tech that's allowing me not only to cook quickly at the end of the day, but make good use of lower-priced ingredients that are also healthy and wholesome. So those beans and the very tough, cheap cuts of meat and trying to satisfy a family that way.
That sounds like a great idea, Sylvia. I'd like to talk to you more about that, but we have just a minute to go, Professor Winston. I'm sure you like the sound of that, and you hope that we're teaching our kids how to cook too.
I think it's very important. It needs to be, you know, introduced into the school curriculum. It is just as important as many of the things we're presently teaching, or much more so even. So start with the kids. They're the best hope. Get those you know, healthy habits, you know, ingrained early. And they'll stay with them a lifetime, and you know, this is what we need to do as a society, and embrace whole food, and find creative ways to make it fit into our busy, stressful lifestyles.
Thank you so much for being with us. Anthony Winston is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Guelph in Ontario. He is the author of The Industrial Diet, The Degradation of Food and the Struggle for Healthy Eating. We thank him very much for being with us, and we thank you for your calls. Hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Our big question is coming up next, and then coming up after 8 o'clock, we will be talking about the origins of good and evil. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.